But I would be like coming in the dark one morning, and I just like hear like what is going on the track, because you can't really see it, the football field. And like it was like kids doing like in fatigues and combat boots, like doing like a burpee broad jump like around the track for like a mile or whatever. And I was like, what are these guys doing? And I was said to her, how are we not involved in this, right? And so that's where we kind of really like started putting the right feelers out. And again, it being at a place like Norwich, I think it's small enough. I think they were prime enough with retention issues and injury rates. So I think it was like, we need to get these experts involved.
Hey guys, welcome back. Another week here with Drew and Alex, your two favorite podcast. That sounds self-inflating. Two podcast hosts here this week, Drew and Alex, Mops and Mo's podcast. Before we kick off, Alex, you mentioned that you wanted to talk really quickly about recycling. So let's hit on that real quick.
It's just a brief rant. I don't have a recycling related platform to put it on, so you're getting it here on a normally fitness focused platform. Just brief stuff about plastic recycling and what does and does not work about it, because I see this all the time when I'm out in public and there's recycling bins and all that kind of stuff. Fundamentally, if you really dig into it, plastic recycling is a failed experiment in its efforts to improve sustainability, but a very successful effort in convincing society that it's okay to consume massive amounts of plastics. People don't understand what goes in the bin. They'll put stuff that's not recyclable or not recyclable in their city in the bin. And what happens is whenever that item is discovered, they throw out whatever container it's in, whether it's in that recycling bin, whether it's in like a commercial size dumpster, they will turn all of that into trash just because one non-recyclable item is in there. It's just not nearly as viable as people think it is. It's great when it works, but I think way less of stuff gets into recycling than people think does. And really all it does is make people feel less guilty about churning through plastic.
Speaking of the environment, I saw a thing today having to do with Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce.
The jet fuel consumption of her flying back to visit him all the time?
Yeah, so they talked about her carbon. So this is the person of the year. And so over the past 3 months alone, I'm reading this. Shout out Economic Times. No free ads. 138 tons of CO2 emissions over the past 3 months is she putting out. So I think she's like 5x the carbon footprint of your normal person. So as you guys are all
sitting, it's got to be way more than 5x. She's flying private all the time. She's, well, I'm saying she's way beyond 5x.
As we're all sitting here, because I use like canvas bags when I go to the grocery store, and like we're all sucking on soggy paper straws thinking that we're saving the sea turtles. Meanwhile, Taylor Swift, again, big fan of the show, Taylor. I know she's a longtime listener of Mops and Mo's, but you know, maybe keep it in check. Maybe FaceTime Travis instead of flying your jet to. I say
before
that
we get, before we get absolutely slammed by the Swifties, we also should be grateful for the billions of dollars she's adding to the economy.
Well, yeah, but think about the carbon footprints of all those people flying to see her.
It's also true.
Man,
it's a tough one.
Listen,
I have no solution to either the recycling problem or the Taylor
Swift
problem.
Can you recycle glass in
yeah,
Colorado Springs?
Glass is much more recyclable.
See, my municipality. Technically, I live in a village. It's technically a village, but we can't recycle glass, so we have to throw it away.
Dang, that's weird.
I mean, it ends up in the same place.
The little logos you see on the bottom of your plastic containers with a number in the middle, those are resin codes. They do not mean it's recyclable. Certain resins are recyclable, certain resins are not recyclable. People don't know that, and they purposely take advantage of that by using the same symbol practically. And everybody forgets that the original symbol is three R's and recycle is only the last one. The first two are reduce and reuse, and they're way more important.
I started composting recently. I mean,
that's fantastic.
Anyway, who are we talking to today?
Yeah, hard pivot. So we got
speaking
Scott
of
Caulfield.
People doing big things.
Yeah, no recycling conversation in the rest of the episode, we promise. Scott Caulfield is our guest. Strength and conditioning coaches will know him, but for
hopefully
those who don't, we're gonna have a little bit of a long bio here because he's done a lot of cool things. Scott earned his bachelor's degree in physical education from Castleton University and his master's in sports coaching from the University of Denver's renowned Graduate School of Professional Psychology. Caulfield is one of the most well-known collegiate strength and conditioning coaches in the industry. He spent 11 years at the NSCA, the National Strength and Conditioning Association, as a coaching education manager and head strength and conditioning coach. Prior to joining the NSCA, he served as an assistant strength and conditioning coach at Dartmouth College for 3 years. During that time, he also served as the director of sports performance for the River Valley Club, one of the most successful training facilities in New England, and as the NSCA's Vermont State Director. After his time at the NSCA, he served as the head strength and conditioning coach at Colorado College, while at the same time teaching in the strength and conditioning graduate degree program at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Over the course of all of that, he's given hundreds of public presentations in both the U.S. and internationally. He became Norwich University's first ever director of strength and conditioning in August 2001. In that role, he directs the development and management of individual and group strength and conditioning programs for over 600 student athletes participating in Norwich University's athletic programs. As you'll hear in this episode, they also have a growing relationship with the ROTC programs there, as Norwich is a senior military college. He holds a certified strength and conditioning specialist with distinction, a registered strength and conditioning coach with distinction from the NSCA, as well as USA Weightlifting's level 2.
He started at Norwich in 2001.
Yeah.
Wow. It's been there for a long time. When you think of Vermont, what season is it?
It's fall.
Every time.
Yeah.
100%. If I close my eyes and think it's fall, I'm not sure. I've never been to Vermont.
I have. It was the fall.
Was it fall? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Another random riff about Vermont.
No, but maybe it was the spring and I just have fall in my
so
head.
So if you Google Vermont, there's like a there's a classic image of like this farmhouse and like it's always fall. And apparently that's... So that little farmhouse and the road that farmhouse sits on became so overcrowded with photographers every year for the fall that they've had to shut the road down for a certain period of time. So like you can't go take pictures of that place. Anyway, Scott, so the reason we had Scott on, one, as you mentioned, he's like a prolific strength and conditioning coach, but also, as you mentioned, he worked at the NSCA for a really long time. And if you have listened to this podcast for any length, you will know that we have a number of different opinions on the NSCA, better or for worse, or for better or for worse. But one thing that we had not yet done was spoken directly with anybody tied to the organization. And so Scott, in some capacity, kind of became that person. And we say this to him at the end, but seriously, big commendations to Scott for coming on and speaking in that capacity. Also, we do touch a little bit on some kind of sensitive, maybe, subjects in strength and conditioning, salary conversations, talking about as well the role of CrossFit and sort of the tactical strength and conditioning space, what that looks like, how coaches can engage with the NSCA, what the maybe the future plans of the organization look like. So a super interesting episode. And for folks that might not be strength and conditioning coaches, I still think that there's a lot of value here for them.
Oh yeah. Some historical context stuff. I mean, part of the conversation goes into like the origins of this industry, and it's not an old industry. It's really new. And I think there's some context there that's valuable. And we know there are tons of folks out in the military that are interested in like continuing to serve in a different capacity by being coaches. There's all sorts of ways this conversation can be valuable.
So hopefully by this point in the introduction, you've learned a little bit about recycling. You have in your mind's eye visualized Vermont in the fall. So now there's nothing left to do but sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hey guys, before we kick this episode off, just wanted to give a quick plug to the two options that we have for folks interested in training with us. We have the team-based Long and Strong program. And then if you are interested in a more engaging, intensive, more tailored option, we offer one-on-one coaching as well.
And you can find both of those on the training tab of our website, mopsandmos.com. And if it's the team training you're interested, click that link and you will find a one-week free trial.
So again, if any of the things that we talk about on this podcast are interesting to you as far as training goes, head to the website, like Alex just mentioned, select that training tab and follow the instructions from there. Enjoy the episode.
I think like the overarching conversation we're hoping to have on this episode is like how coaches are educated.
You're our NSCA subject matter expert.
And gotcha. I'd kind of like to know before we get into like the real episode here, how comfortable you are digging into like the way NSCA rolls on a recorded conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it'd be good to also just like help people like paint the landscape of like what that even looks like. Right. Cause like, I think people just think, and I think everybody thought it until you like go or till you actually either meet someone that works there like me or Nate Palin or whoever, like you think that there's just people walking around in lab coats with like goniometers and they're measuring joint angle. And they're like, nope, stop. You can't do that yet. You know? And then they're like immediately typing it into journals that are getting published in the back and someone's boxing them, which, you know, and I think obviously I thought that a little to some degree, but like when you get out there, you realize like, wow, there's only like 100 people that work there and they're trying to do all this stuff. And there's, wow, there's only two people that have actually coached athlete or, you know, so it can be a, yeah, no, I think it'll be a fun topic to kind of get into. And I think it was just on the last, I just listened to one with Kenchi, the one about the Kichi, his yeah, paper. Kichi. So Kenchi, and it's, and you know, said something about how the essentials text, right, doesn't even have a chapter on that. And that's something, because I was an author for the fourth edition, which was the last update to the essentials text. And I've done a lot of coaching philosophy stuff and my own through my master's program with Dr. G and at DU. And just, so I was been beating that drum for a long time. In 2015 was actually when I started my master's, was when that edition came out. And I was saying then, like, how is there nothing on coaching in this book? Like on like how to coach, right? Or why coaching philosophy, the number one question you get asked. So yada, yada. Anyway, no, I think it's good. Cause I do think whenever that fifth edition comes, that's going to be that'll be an added part of that book.
How do they, like, I have so many curious questions having just sort of been on the outside for so long. How do they decide what gets put into those? I mean, we could call them like seminal textbooks and what doesn't make the cut. Like if you're one of the authors and you're beating the drum for this philosophy thing and it just doesn't make it in, how does that get decided?
Yeah. I mean, it's the editors, it's human kinetics to some degree, I think owning a little bit of the, you know, being in that market as a publisher, they know what people buy. So I think to some degree they have some control over it. And then, you know, the NSCA side, you have the publications director who has to lobby for that stuff with the editors. And again, if they're not really gonna want to, you know, rock the boat a little and get into it, I mean Travis Triplett and Greg Hoff were the two editors on the fourth edition, and I think I think neither of them would doubt that. You know, you could argue, they wouldn't argue with you that needs to be an area covered. It just comes down to then like being able to make it like, All right, can you guys all decide that this is important? It needs to be added. So I think if the editors and the NSCA were like, hey, we have to add this in, there's been this much body of knowledge and work put into it, let's add it. Then obviously human kinetics at that point is going to be like, okay, right. You guys, this is truly your content. So yeah, duly noted. We're going to add another chapter. It's going to be 26, whatever. Yeah.
Hands up. And you've probably heard this if you've listened to the episodes. Like, I'm not a cynic necessarily. I just see, and Alex and I have both said this before, like, especially in the tactical space, I can't really speak for professional or collegiate sport, but like tactically, it's like a massive, it's becoming a massive industry. And we've had so many conversations with people. And you do look at kind of that essentials textbook and you're like, man, what is it that keeps it, I guess, a little bit, maybe, I don't know, disconnected seems like an aggressive word, but like a little bit disconnected from what we're seeing on the ground. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you, and maybe this is the right time to do it, is from the NSCA's perspective and you as a coach in that organization dealing with, like you mentioned, a lot of, you know, professionals that might not be coaches, how do you strike a balance or how valuable is kind of anecdotal coaching experience versus evidence-backed research, if that makes sense, when it comes down to like curriculum and messaging and all that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important. It's why I think we had a big push, you know, when I was there and Tyler Christensen and a few of the others who were there at the same time, where we kind of were gaining a lot more traction or getting a lot more coaches back, people would say. But I think it was before, because we had more coaches involved, whether that was through task forces or people who end up being subject matter experts on like the exam development committee, for instance, is one that, you know, those guys work on the different exams. And then you have people that are involved as author chapters in the book. So I think, you know, and just like from a marketing perspective, like we would go into meetings all the time with different, they'd have different thoughts about what, you know, that something, whatever XYZ should look like. And then myself or someone else who's actually spent enough time in the trenches coaching would be like, no, like, nope, that's not a snatch, right? Like, so yeah, that can't go in that picture, right? So it'd be, and that, you know, those have notoriously gotten through the cracks, you know, time to time, and you'll people will be like, yeah, I remember that article they posted and the guy was doing whatever. Yeah.
That's a barbell curl, not a snatch.
Yeah.
I do feel bad sometimes. I work with Jason Swall a bunch now, and he was at the NSCA before this. And like the very first time I met him in person, I like immediately just walked up to him and went off on something that was in the new exercise science textbook that was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he's like, yeah, that happens. We got it.
Yeah. So it's a process. That's why it's important. Like I was really, really fortunate and grateful to be able to go work there and spend as long as I did. I don't know that, you know, I had no intention of staying there close to a decade. Not that I do for any job, but you know, we did a lot of good stuff at that time. And I felt like, you know, a lot of it was just being able to bring that real coaching voice to be able to make changes and say, this is what people want. And, you know, that was part of doing the podcast that I got to do for the first three seasons of the NSCA coaching podcast. So just getting able to really be authentic and talk about the real part of strength and conditioning. But I guess, you know, it's always going to be, there's become much more weight, and you see it, you know, people will complain about it in the areas like committees and board of directors, typically, right? Those positions skew more toward having an academic background and mm-hmm. PhD. And right, I mean, you think about it, a lot of those people have more time, right? They have more time to write, and they have more time to apply for stuff and be on meetings and different go to events. They get credit toward tenure and whatnot for speaking at events. And so a lot of college coaches, professional and even tactical, you know, are going to have trouble getting away from their job to be involved in these different things. And so I think that's also why it's critically important that coaches, myself, you know, any full-time coach is trying to stay involved with the organization, because we have to be the ones, you know, to help bring the pendulum back in the right direction, if you want to call it that, right? Or, you know, really make sure that we're staying, that real coaching is getting through as much as, you know, this wide spectrum of, yes, everybody has to know this, but right, are we just, is it just the permit test that, right, I'm taking so that I am now, right, like eligible to drive the car, which is really what certification is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've learned how to, and then I learn how to coach, hopefully while I'm doing that internship, except whatever else. And then I learn on the fly in my job as well, because I'm actually implementing it.
And the 10 years you were there, what were maybe your top three, or what was your top kind of achievement that you look back on and you're like, man, I'm really glad that I got to do that.
I think even though it happened after I left, the NSCA TV, where all the content from the different events is now being housed and put into a format where people can view it. So those videos, all those events we used to do, really just used to die in folders. And I mean, from day one that I was there, I was like, this is unreal. Like this should be on demand, whatever. Like we should have access to it. I would say that was definitely up there. That did come to fruition after I left. I mean, I think again, anecdotally, people come up to me and say a lot that we really did a better job engaging strength college professional strength and conditioning coaches at the time I was there. So I feel good about that. And that was something that, you know, John Jost, who was on the board of directors, who was at Florida State as a strength coach forever, And Boyd Epley, who founded the organization. And then I was fortunate enough that Boyd was actually at headquarters when I went to work there for a few years before I went back to Nebraska. And so, you know, I got to do a mentorship under Boyd, and like in his Boyd in his 60s. So like his full gamut of experience from everything. And it wasn't as much about training as it was about like getting shit done, for lack of a better word. Like he was the master of just being able to make things happen. And so that was awesome. And then from a training perspective, we did have the facility at HQ. And so in 2014, I got to work with the Paralympic sled hockey team before they went to Sochi for the Sochi Paralympic Games. And that was just awesome because there was a bunch of wounded vets on there, people with, you know, injuries from motorcycle accidents or youth or whatever, just born that way. And so getting to work with that Paralympic sled hockey team was just an awesome experience. I trained them for about 8 weeks before they went to the games. It was such a great experience from just that type of mindset they have, and just the people that were on that team were awesome.
And you mentioned Boyd Epley, and I know that hopefully a lot of coaches know who that is, but for people that don't, can you just give a quick, who is Boyd and what was that like to be able to spend time under that type of coach?
Yeah, it was incredible. I was thinking about the other day, because I really didn't do traditional internships. I was a little bit older getting into strength conditioning because I had gone to the military first and then went to college. And, but I look back, I'm like, oh, I didn't really do many internships, but man, I had a full-time internship with Boyd for like 5 years. And we worked out together during that time. So I just got all of the ins and outs and picked his brain at all the right times. But yeah, if you don't really know who he is, I mean, he's been called the godfather of strength conditioning, really one of the first college strength coaches in the country. He was a thrower himself and injured, and worked through his own rehab to get himself back, and then started training some guys at Nebraska, just a few of the players that were in the weight room when he was there, because they were also injured. And long story short, he got in front of the football coach and was able, they were like, hey, listen, this guy does the strength training stuff with these guys, and you know, the guys like him and they're seeing good results. And basically, I think it was Tom Osborne at the time, or whoever was the actual head coach, told him, okay, we're gonna let you work with the guys, but if one person gets slower, you're fired. And so that was the thought, because they just thought lifting weights made him slower. And so again, long story short, that turned into Husker Power and the powerhouse of 5 national championships and everything in between. And so Boyd, but again, at that time, strength conditioning was so new, right? What Boyd was doing was reaching out to the other strength coaches that they played at Nebraska and other people, and they were sending each other letters and compiling testing results and just sharing information. And so that's where it first evolved to. And the organization was actually called the National Strength Coaches Association, was the first name they came up with, same NSCA. And then it evolved to National Strength and Conditioning Association somewhere after that, fine. But, you know, that first meeting or whatever it was in 1978. But before that time, they were sending each other, you know, letters through the mail and waiting for however long it took to get them and read them and get that info out to each other. And then they started doing a journal. And yeah, so it really literally snowballed from the bit, you know, the realest grassroots level that you can imagine to what it is now, is this, you know, overarching huge conglomerate that has 50,000 members and 4 certifications, or 5 if you count CSPS still, but I don't know if they do. Mm.
So you mentioned your non-traditional route into strength and conditioning, and I think we're gonna end up back at some of the stuff you're doing at Norwich, but I want to rewind way back and go over some of the like the way you entered into this industry and the context that gives it. And I wanted to start with, I did not know this until looking you up before bringing you on for this episode, but you initially got your bachelor's degree in physical education. And we've talked about it a lot here, like the role coaches have in essentially doing like remedial physical education with certain populations, right? Just because of the state of physical education in this country. And I wanted to ask how that background brought you to where you are and how you integrate that and stuff.
Well, yeah, I think the PE background is just invaluable for strength and conditioning coaches. I mean, I thought, you know, with the coursework from pedagogy and just like basic coaching classes that you learn in physical education, coaching hours, reflection things you have to do. I think that the development of the, you know, physical characteristics that you're going to have to teach or that everyone's going to have to learn at some point, you know, is built into the curriculum in PE. So it just, it made it a much more streamlined process, I felt, or I felt much more comfortable coaching and working with people in that setting, I think, because you're doing it as a physical education coach with little kids all through your development of those years and whatnot. The only, I didn't want to do another year of college at that point, which is why I didn't do student teaching. And then that's kind of how the path evolved into what it evolved to. But I, you know, it was really the curriculum and coursework from, again, pedagogy up through the things that, you know, all those different aspects of being a PE teacher that were developmental. And I had coached basketball too for a long time, so I had been involved as a camp counselor and different things through that. So it was really just evolving, right? Coaching, physical training, and just coaching, basically, you know, leading them.
Do you think that one of the things that seems to come up quite a bit, and we'll probably have more discussion on this, but, you know, you mentioned physical education, and one of the things that we've noticed with, especially coaches with these much bigger tactical programs where you've got one coach for, you know, 500, 1,000 soldiers, there is a massive educational component to that. Whereas I think a lot of folks getting hired into those roles are assuming that it's going to be much more your traditional strength and conditioning, you know, squat racks, loud music, yelling, screaming, psyching dudes up, that kind of thing. And I'm wondering if there's a world where we might see a little bit more overlap between the formalized physical education curriculum and kind of the strength and conditioning curriculum. And I think back to when I was in graduate school and like the first day we had our orientation in Edinburgh, you know, I'm with the Masters of Strength and Conditioning cohort, and lo and behold, there's a Masters of Physical Education. I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing, but we never crossed paths with those guys for the remainder of the program. It was like two completely separate things. And I'm just rambling question, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on more overlap between that education piece and the pedagogy piece and just working with athletes versus here's Prilipin's chart, reps, sets, Soviet periodization, go coach.
Yeah, I think it's got to be in there and we've got to figure out how to blend it better. I think smaller places like Norwich, for example, like with less degree program options, like you're able to cross over more of those things because you might have more commonality in some of the electives and whatnot, right? So I think, you know, depending on where you are, some people are able to do it. I think the program that I went through in my master's at the University of Denver was in sport coaching, was what the actual master's was called. And it's much more, if you know Dr. Garrity at all, like it's much more sociology and psychology based. I think he's the president of NAS now, North American Sports Sociology, or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it was much more involved in like how to coach and how to interact with people and how to manage groups and what you do and what you'd, how you'd act if, or how you'd react to X happening. And then, you know, being able to base scenarios off that. So I think it's coming more and more as we're realizing it and this profession is growing. And, you know, obviously the tactical space is helping it grow rapidly with the amount of rollout with all the H2F gigs and all the different stuff going on. So mm-hmm. I think it's becoming more and more, but that I remember Mark Taysom when he was out at Fort Carson working with one of those first brigades that he had, whatever it was, fourth brigade or somebody. And it was like he was seeing people like once every 3 weeks or something, you know, the same group. And that when I heard that, I was like, what, like, how is that even possible? Cause I thought it was more like traditional where he had those groups.
I'll shout that out real quick. Cause Mark was my first exposure to strength and conditioning. Really. I was in fourth ID when he was there.
Dr. Seuss of, no, isn't that his episode? Dr.
Yeah,
Seuss.
He was the Dr. Seuss episode on here. Look him up. He's amazing. Awesome. And there's a crossover here too, because he hired Chase Bidek to work with him, and Chase is married to Boyd Epley's daughter. It's a small world.
Yeah. We've done more name dropping in this episode than I think we've ever done before.
But But I know I've talked to, I don't think Dr. East said it when he came on our podcast, but I have heard Dr. East say that Mark's program at Fort Carson was essentially the template for H2F and the concept of a Soldier Performance Readiness Center and things like that. And it was cool to see what he was doing, 'cause it was different, right? Like we, at best, we would see him once a week, maybe. I know all my soldiers looked forward to TAP Day, Tactical Athlete Program. It was like the best PT day of the week. And like on a good day, he'd like rotate several companies through over the course of the day, but then he would not see them again for a couple weeks, or like they'd go off to the field or whatever it was. So there had to be both a strength and conditioning session happening and leader development happening, where he's teaching the why behind what he's doing to the leaders of that organization while they're doing the training, so that they can incorporate it when they're on their own.
He was also, he's also freakishly old man strength.
Yes.
One of the greatest greatest attributes I think he has is his credibility to, as well as his ability to meet people where they're at. Right. Like that guy is just strong.
Have people seen him do any jumping plyometric kind of stuff? That's incredible too. It's unreal. So for another one to like work us back up to where you're at with Norwich and what you're doing now. You mentioned briefly that you're a Navy veteran, file that as well under things I did not know about you until I looked you up before this episode. But you did 4 years in the Navy, followed by like nearly 20 years not touching tactical, just out in the strength conditioning world, mostly with sport. What about your time in the Navy shaped the decision to go into strength and conditioning? And is it part of why you're involved in tactical stuff now?
I wouldn't say it's what, not really much to do with tactical. I wasn't a good student. I went to college for 2 years. My second year, I spent most of my time at the pool and the weight room, though. So I was kind of, you know, evolving into my future career. But I basically just didn't go to class, and that doesn't end up very well. So I joined the Navy, what would have been my third year in college. And I had full intention of just going in and getting the GI Bill and getting out. And that's kind of where I stayed my focus. I was on an amphibious assault ship, an LPH, for those listening in the know. So we carried helicopters and Marines. So always have a fondness in my heart for Marines. Got to do some cool stuff and see a lot of places, right? Obviously that no one is ever going to see, which was really the coolest aspect of it. But I really stayed true to it. And I'm like, I'm getting out, I'm going to college. And I would say that while the entire time I was in, I was still training. I was, you know, I was training now. Other guys in my division and in the air department were asking me about training. And so I ended up training those guys, right? And that was very much muscle and fitness based. You know, I was didn't know really anything except that I played a lot of basketball. I lifted a lot of weights at that point for a couple of years. And I noticed the correlation between those two. Huh, I can run faster and jump higher and I'm less injured. All right. So that, at least the, those things were starting to click for me. And again, I just did a lot of training with my peers at that point, unofficially, basically. And then the goal was just to get back out, use that GI Bill and go back to school. And that's really what I did. And then again, being at NSCA HQ, even though I took over actually when Tyler left. And then it must have been before we hired Nate, was a little bit of a gap in that period. So I was actually, I took over as the tactical, from a coaching perspective, not really doing anything with the tactical program in our actual facility. I took over the SWAT guys and any other our FBI team that we had out there, any tactical athletes like that. Then I ran the show for those guys. But just being there during that time, I always would hang out when they were there. The NSCA Performance Center isn't really like a full-time either, you know, tactical or college weight room, right? So there's not just a stream of people coming through there at all times of the day. So really, if we had a team like the SWAT guys or a team that I had, Colorado College Hockey, whatever it might be, that was just a good time to either hang out if you weren't involved or just be around and see what they do. And so I would get to see, why does Tyler program what he does? And why does Nate do what he does? And, you know, all those people that had come through there, we had all the old programs from Mark Stevenson and Rob Rogers and Greg Infantino and all these guys, you know, that were the pioneers of the tactical space that, you know, went into those gigs, right, initially. So, you know, I had access to all those programs and to look at the ins and outs of why they did things and how they programmed. So that was a cool experience. And again, coming back to the Norwich thing, I had no intention of coming back here. Like I said, it is where I grew up, and I was fortunate enough that things worked out the way they did. And now being at a senior military college as a Navy veteran, it's super cool. You know, kids will see it all the time. I got to do a first salute in September with one of my interns and students that we had last year, which was just a super cool thing. Never thought I'd put a uniform on again. So just some of those things that have happened, you know, you can't even imagine or dream up, but it's all, again, it's lended to me becoming a good voice of authority at Norwich as this SME for everything physical training related. And to that point, like the commandant, who's the vice president of all the Corps of Cadets and students, right, and civilian students, like will tell the cadre and his training staff, you know, his colonels that are under him, hey, make sure somebody run this by Coach Caulfield and see what he thinks about it, whether it's. So like I've become elevated into almost like the go-to person for the entire university, even though that's not really my job. Although hopefully it's going to evolve into that, I think, in the future.
Has the, and maybe this is less so at Norwich's level, but I know we've spoken about this at like a West Point level. Has the fact that there are now kind of embedded subject matter experts in active duty military, you know, command structures, has that changed the conversations you have at all with your cadets in terms of like longevity of this type of mindset, being an athlete, training appropriately, et cetera, or has it not yet trickled down to that level?
No, I think it's helping. I think that they're seeing and hearing about it at every, you know, in all these different areas. They're getting hit from it in their military training now. So I think it's helped because they now, you know, now I'm having some of our specialty companies have come reached out to me, and, you know, they're saying, well, they're like, well, we know that we have a, you know, a professional who is a professional strength coach on our campus. Why wouldn't we use them? You know, is kind of their mindset. So, no, it's been very helpful in that these kind of crossroads have already been starting to be laid down. And I think our students are seeing it, our cadets are seeing it as an opportunity. The more knowledgeable they are about proper training now and proper recovery and nutrition, all the aspects of physical preparation, it's going to help them as an officer more, especially if they're really interested in it. And you know as well as any, a lot of them are very, very, very interested in it and very passionate about it, even if it's not your major.
Mm-hmm. Did your uniform still fit when you put it on?
Oh God, no! I had to piece that thing together with some Army Navy stores, and yeah, I don't even know where the old one would have been located. Yeah, I have no idea. But yeah, my buddy Colonel Conway, who just retired from here, he was he's the head of our Marine Corps ROTC last year, and he was like, "Man, that's gonna be expensive." I was like, "Well, sometimes it pays to be enlisted, sir." Like, yeah, it wasn't that bad.
Oh man.
So now that we're back up to current, because you are involved in both like non-tactical strength conditioning and tactical in your role at Norwich, if I'm not mistaken, like you're involved in the ROTC stuff and things like that. Yeah. And something I've thought a lot about, and I did a brief check. As far as I can tell, Norwich doesn't offer tactical as a major, but it does offer a course focused on tactical. Yeah. And I've kind of been wondering, because I haven't heard like a good answer to this one, and you'd think I would know the answer to this given what I do, but I don't really know what distinguishes tactical strength and conditioning from strength and conditioning in general, because you're still just applying needs analysis just to a slightly different setting and population and things like that. And then you proceed from there kind of as you would normally, other than kind of the day-to-day environment and the bureaucracy and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, from your perspective as someone who teaches a course on the subject, and kind of a second part to that question of what are your thoughts on those schools that are making it its own major?
Yeah, I think there's not, right, there's not a ton of difference. It's strength and conditioning. What we are talking about though, right, we're giving them different aspects of it to think about: woodland firefighting, structural firefighting, law enforcement, military, you know, there's, and the military obviously is a wide gamut, right? Between support staff and special operations and all the different levels of special operations even. So it's, I think it's just understanding nuances of those different jobs, just like you would teach in strength and conditioning course. Okay, well, what's your needs analysis for this college basketball player? Okay, yeah, what's your needs analysis for this, you know, 42-year-old Green Beret who's been, you know, as close to retirement? So how is your program and thinking around that? So I think that's the only differences really are those nuances and specificity areas of the different tactical professions. But I mean, yeah, like you said, it's strength conditioning. We don't have it. We teach, so I did, I taught the course. I teach HHPR 307 is tactical strength conditioning. I taught that last year. It will be offered next year, so it kind of goes every other. But Dr. Bajednik, who I know you know, just got finished. It's, I don't think it's on the website yet, but so we will have a it's an online certificate. So it's an undergraduate certificate in tactical strength and conditioning. So there's going to be a strength and conditioning piece. There's going to be a sports nutrition piece. And I believe that third aspect is a sports psychology piece. And so I don't know if it's four classes or four or five that'll make up this graduate certificate. So we will have that at Norwich and through the graduate school of the online school coming soon. It might be ready next year. She's been working on it pretty much full time, I think. So I know that it's very close. And I don't see why that certainly wouldn't be an emphasis in our degree program down the road too. But to answer your question, really, no, it's just understanding some of the nuances, I think, load bearing, right? Rucking, how load carriage affects training and different things. Aren't many sports, right, that we have to worry about that in. So just understand those little differences and nuances. It's really just those specificities of the athlete.
I want to give a friendly knock to the NSCA here and get your thoughts on this. And I'm guilty of this as well, but I know that some of the commentary, probably jokingly, around like the TSAC certification versus the CSCS is like, oh, well, the TSAC is just the CSCS. They just changed athlete to firefighter or athlete to soldier. Yeah, and it's the same. It's the same thing. And I'm curious from where you sat at the NSCA and what you saw at that organization, like, is there room or resources or the space to have the conversation around maybe taking it a step further in terms of like the things we've already talked about, a huge component of psychology, a huge element of education, because, you know, you mentioned like that senior Green Beret. I don't think if you take the CSCS as an example, and you go into that weight room at that, you know, at that ODA, and you're thinking linebacker, you're thinking basketball player, you're not thinking like, here's a guy who has seen a ton of stuff, probably has a ton of stressors outside of what we're dealing with here. Was I prepared for that conversation having just taken the CSCS, or could the TSAC go a step further and incorporate more of a holistic approach?
I'll add a layer before Scott answers too, just to say that I think there's a really high frequency of coaches coming into tactical thinking it's just going to be a college weight room with different outfits. Mm-hmm. And there's a learning curve of figuring out what
I think the it goes tactical both role ways.
Really is. And I think part of that, we need to do a better job of making sure aspiring coaches that are interested in getting into tactical know some of these differences ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. The evolution is going to happen and be reflected in the resources better. I mean, you know, that the TSAC book, for lack of a better example, you know, that's in its first edition. That was written, a lot of the SMEs that contributed to that book, right, were the men and women on that kind of first level of being involved in tactical space, whether it was special operators or other areas. And so a lot of them, though, had only worked with sporting athletes before they got into the tactical space, right? So, I mean, those first guys that got hired by Dev Group and whoever else, all those, you know, different soft organizations, they were intentionally seeking out the Paul Goldbergs and the people from professional and collegiate sports. So I think, you know, it did evolve from that. And now that those guys have been in it for 15 or so, 20 years, maybe some coming up on it, now they do have enough experience and knowledge specific to the tactical populations they've been working with that it definitely, you know, should be that next level. So it's just, you know, how it's going to be, because again, and you guys have probably heard this, right? The TSAC certification, the TSAC F, from everything that the messaging that I learned about it working at NSDA was that it was designed for people who had been in the military for, you know, and were sergeant, staff sergeant, whatever, 15 plus years, didn't have a degree, but that still needed to have an extra layer of knowledge within this realm mm-hmm. of strength and conditioning. And so that's really who it was designed for. And at this point, it's still, that book still sits as the main study guide for that test, right? So it's still that basic level of knowledge for that group, for that population. So, and you know, until that's able to evolve a little and be updated, right, that's kind of why it is what it is, for lack of a better experience or description for that, right?
I want to ask a question about a little bit of what I would assume is an NSCA boogeyman, and I don't want to, CrossFit is where I'm going to go with this. And I don't want to necessarily go into the lawsuit history and all of that, because, you know, I could care less. But more importantly, one of the things that I at least have seen on the ground, and I know a lot of coaches, especially coming from the special operations world, have seen, is that the stereotypical tactical athlete is coming from some sort of quote unquote functional fitness background, call it CrossFit, SEALFit, Jim Jones, whatever. And in a lot of environments, that conflicts sometimes with a traditional strength coach who might be thinking more along the lines of, like, again, using quotations, like what you would learn in the CSCS. Is there a world where, like, maybe some of that multimodality education could evolve within NSCA curriculum without triggering a ton of people and triggering a bunch of bad blood and all that? Or is it just completely off the table? Because
I think so. There's so many coaches that are using aspects of it in their programming already. Like, it's being integrated throughout, you know, all levels of programming, whether they have a credential in that actual sport or not. But mm-hmm. Is it going to be your primary methodology? Probably not, right? Like, but you know, I always say everything works, nothing works forever. Like, at the end of the day, that's really, I think I stole that from Dan John, but like, at the end of the day, to some degree, as long as you're not hurting people, because you see it all the time, different people have different training styles based on their philosophies, facilities, resources, right? And so you end up with a lot of different training aspects, and a lot of them, maybe some of the principles are similar, but not all of them. And you have people doing really well on these different programs. And again, you know, it goes back to, again, the episode we mentioned with Kinchy, with the research that he did. Training was like the fifth on the list of, you know, things that people mm-hmm. felt that were influenced, that were influenced their training, and thus they're going to be better bought in, give better effort, whatever it might be. So I think the other funny thing you made me think of when you said that is Jay Dawes, who I know you guys know too well, mm-hmm. told me he had been at the NSCA before me. He told me best analogy that I have heard is that when you go to work at NSCA headquarters, it's like when you find out for the first time that Santa Claus isn't real. And so, like, you get there and then you're looking,
I thought you were Santa Claus.
Yeah, you're looking around for the people with the lab coats and the goniometers, and you're like, wait, I thought they're not here.
Oh man. I guess maybe as a follow-on along those same lines, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, one, because of your time at the NSCA, but then two, just kind of with your experience as a strength coach, another thing that we see quite frequently in the tactical space is just the prevalence of, we'll call them social media coaches, for better or for worse. And I know with as frequently as athletes are able to access things like Instagram, TikTok, whatever, you do kind of see certain concepts, certain ideas become really, really popular. I mean, the one that comes to mind for me is the whole hybrid training thing. For a lot of folks, that starts in, you know, the YouTube space, the Instagram space, because you see these guys doing a triathlon, lifting a ton of weight. Is that, are those types of things discussed in the NSA? Do they talk about how do we incorporate some of this stuff? Maybe we should reach out and talk to these folks about how they're doing what they're doing, or is it just noise?
Yeah, I think sometimes if it carries enough weight, probably. Again, like I would say, if you think about it, you have 1 to 3 people, you know, at NSCHQ that are designated to that space. So whether it's college professional strength conditioning coaches, tactical sports science. So those, you know, those 1 to 3 people need to help with whatever committee or board of director that's able to leverage, you know, the things they think is important from the 30,000 foot space. Mm-hmm. Is this enough of an important emphasis that we need to add it in, or that we need to spend time on it? And I think some of the times, just some of those things don't have enough bang for their buck to get to the level where they're going to get, some love, or, you know, some more attention, no matter, yeah, even if it's needed. So it is. And again, that's another reason why I think it's important that more tactical and college professional strength coaches get involved in the organization, because they're the ones seeing it on the front lines. They're the ones, you know, realizing these are the needs. And so they have to stay involved to keep the people, to keep us moving forward in the right areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have just answered this, and the answer might be it is those 1 to 3 people in each one. But is there a real mechanism for the NSCA to receive feedback from the field? Is it just making sure those people have the right relationships and are hearing it organically? Or are there mechanisms in place, or should there be mechanisms in place for like more direct channels than that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because the people that give the most feedback typically, right, are the people that are the biggest complainers, or that are your biggest supporters. So
we know how that goes.
Nobody in the middle. That's how it is all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So it becomes a tough one to figure out too. But no, I think, you know, the board of directors with the 30,000 foot view, it's their job to help drive the ship, and they need to be on the forefront. So they need to be heavily involved in the whatever aspect area they represent for the board, for the demographics of the membership. It's the people on the committees who can have a voice and, you know, get in front of the people at HQ that can influence some changes. Again, like my other favorite Navy analogy, of course, is to getting things done there, is it's like trying to turn an aircraft carrier, right? So again, and you guys understand that from the tactical side of things, like when you want to, yeah, it's like, yeah, of course we know that needs to be added to the essentials textbook for that chapter on coaching philosophy and relationship building. But okay, well, we're still making that turn right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Your time spent in the collegiate space, and also your time at the NSA, makes you just ripe for all these questions that I've had rolling around in my head for so long. But you've mentioned Ketchy's episode now, and Ketchy's one of our favorites to have on. He's come back on actually since then. But one of the things we've talked about with him a number of times is kind of this gap between the academic / research space and the coaching space, and how, you know, is there a way to somehow bridge that gap? Is there a way for the NSCA to kind of sit in the middle of that and somehow connect researchers with coaches? And would there even be any interest in that kind of thing happening? And I guess the question there, is there anything that the NSCA currently does, or something that they're interested in taking on, where we might see a better connection between researchers and coaches? Because again, I'll throw my hand up here, quite frankly, like, you opened the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, and like, I could not care less about single leg plyometrics for kickball players in, you know, Norway. But yeah, I'll turn it over to you.
I will do a brief note for those listening. By the time this episode comes out, you'll have heard the second episode with Ketchy, which dives into some stuff around periodization and history of exercise science and things like that. But Scott has not heard it yet because it doesn't come out until a couple days after we're having this conversation.
Catchy inception here. Sorry. Anyway, back to you, Scott.
Remind me of
the. I want to know what the outlook from the NSCA looks like, which is a weird way of phrasing that, but bridging this gap between researchers and coaches so that the questions being asked by researchers make sense to coaches, and then vice versa, the questions that coaches want answered get elevated to the level of research.
Yeah, I think that is where that's where we see the places that have really good relationships between strength and conditioning research and practitioners are able to, for lack of a better word, do more stuff together, right? Well, when they're more collaborative, that's where the rubber's meeting the road. And unfortunately, until more of that happens, you are just going to have more, papers on single leg plyometrics for kickball players.
But I don't know if that's an actual paper. Yeah, I totally made that up.
That part of it has to be part of it has to be people. Sometimes you get lucky and that's so for instance, I'm on the NSCA Foundation board of directors also. And just by chance, our CEO executive director just mentioned to me, hey, Paul Comfort has this research money left over from the pandemic. He didn't get to use it. He's doing this microdosing stuff. And I told him that he should connect with you and blah, blah. Anyway, long story short, I reached out to Dr. Comfort. He's coming over from the UK later in January. And we're going to do a microdosing study on strength training for a bunch of different teams at Norwich. And then our Ranger company, who I mentioned, came to me and asked me to take over their programming for this next semester. And so I reached out to Dr. Brandon Roberts, who I had as a speaker at one of my events, and he's down in Boston at the AIEMS. I'm going to mess it up, but the Army Environmental Medicine something. Anyway, long story short, I was like, hey, I'm going to train these guys this semester. Want to write something up about it? And he was like, heck yeah, let's do it. So I think sometimes it's going to come down to the people on the ground, whether it's a researcher or practitioner. And it's places, look at Texas A&M now, even though it's not specifically tactical. Dr. Brian Mann's out there, Bo Sandoval, Tommy Moffitt just got up there for the football strength coach. Like, they've got this perfect storm of all these heavy hitters in research and practitioner strength conditioning. So I would expect they're going to start doing some cool stuff. And so I think, again, I think it's a matter of the right people in the right places. There's not really a good design for that, right? We don't have a way, hey, this is how you do it. But maybe out of that is going to come some opportunities for, like, I'll talk a little bit at the coaches conference in January. I'm talking about it, just how kind of we do things at Norwich and in our small facility and the system that we have. But I'm just going to lay some of those things out there, like, hey, well, this is what I did. And, our exercise science professors also are going to put me on every paper that they write because I'm going to help collect data or whatever it might be. So if you want to get involved, there are ways to do it. And so you can see that other side of the coin too. Mm-hmm.
So because you mentioned it, I want to bring it up because one of the questions we got all the time in my last position was from ROTC programs who were trying to navigate working with their universities, whether it's athletic department, strength conditioning staff, whatever. And one of the classic missteps we saw was ROTC people walking in and demanding services. we know that's not the right answer.
Yeah.
But I think Norwich is a somewhat unique environment being a senior military college and things like that. But I'd love to hear a little bit about what you guys have seen as far as lessons learned in how ROTC programs and strength and conditioning programs working together can be mutually beneficial, not just something that the ROTC program needs from strength and conditioning, but ways both programs can help the other.
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because I have one full-time assistant, just the two of us, and we have, you know, we're technically responsible for our 22 varsity teams and a little over 600 athletes. So anything that we do on the side. But again, when Dr. Pochednik and I got to Norwich around the same time in 21, and she and I couldn't believe that there was just no integration from the subject matters experts on campus with the Corps of Cadets. And like, and I just laugh because, you know, it's just training at its best, but I would be like coming in the dark one morning and I just like hear like, what is going on the track? Cause you can't really see it, the football field. And like, it was like kids doing like in fatigues and combat boots, like doing like a burpee broad jump, like around the track for like a mile or whatever. And so I was tactical. Like, what are these guys doing? And I was said to her, how are we not involved in this? Right. And so that's where we kind of really like started putting the right feelers out. And again, it being at a place like Norwich, I think it's small enough. I think they were prime enough with retention issues and injury rates. So I think it was like, we need to get these experts involved. And you know, the first year she and I just did like a really small 2-hour kind of lecture / PowerPoint on, you know, basic training for basic strength conditioning training, how not to hurt people. Evolved a little bit this past year. Again, as I took over the class of tactical strength conditioning, we got more of the cadets that were underclassmen that were going to be, we call them MFTs and PTIs, right? So we got more of them involved taking tactical from me. And then some of them wanted to intern. And so it's been a process of just continually trying to get involved. And now again, like I'll have people from the Corps of Cadets, whether it's ROTC or specialty units, hey, can we just run our program by you? And so I just try and go above and beyond to do it as much as I can fit it into my schedule. Again, I hope that the job evolves into a higher, you know, kind of more overarching position that I could be like over all of the physical preparation with support, you know, on the Corps of Cadets side. So that's the part we're at now. We have a really great Master Gunnery Sergeant who's on the Army ROTC side, who wants to get us to help as much as possible, but also he's willing to do as much work as he can to support us. So as much as I can help kind of get him up to speed and use some of the tools that we have, like our Volt Athletics app, and the Lumen Wellness app that I've worked with. So we're trying to integrate more of that, which is like wellness RP and sleep data, and just try and continue the evolution. So, you know, I really think we need some people under me that, you know, I'd love to have a strength coach ATC on both sides of the space, tactical side and athletic side. Obviously we have that system set up in athletics. We don't have it in the Corps of Cadets yet, but I think we're going to get there.
As you talk about kind of the maybe future trajectory of your position and overseeing, you know, you mentioned an ATC, and it brings me to a question that I've asked kind of to myself and to other folks in this space for a long time now, which is that often in the tactical environment, you know, you get these holistic teams, right? Where you have a strength coach, a physical therapist. In some cases, there might even be a physician or a PA. And in my past life, I've worked alongside orthopedic surgeons. And it's interesting because in that room, in those meetings, there's a level of professionalism with an ATC, a PT, an MD. And inevitably the strength coach is the one who spends the most time with the athletes. I mean, we're with these guys every single day. We get to know them really well, but for one reason or another, it's hard to be taken as seriously because you don't have the same, you know, there's not a board certification. There's not, obviously an MD is a totally different conversation, but from an NSCA standpoint, what do you think can be done maybe to sort of elevate the entire industry? So we get above kind of, and this is no offense to like the Gray Sweatpants Society, but like we kind of elevate ourselves above that to the level of like, hey, I know that I understand you're an orthopedic surgeon. I understand you're a dietitian. I understand you're a physical therapist. Here's me as a strength and conditioning specialist. And what I bring to the table is equally as important. And in some cases more important, despite the fact that my, you know, certification is an online test, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is to how you're positioning yourself.
For sure.
Right. Are you, I love gray sweatpants. So are you walking around in your gray sweats most of the time? Or like, yeah. Are you showing up at a meeting that has, that you got invited to, that the commandant and the, you know, VP of faculty is in, and you, that's the day that you're not wearing sweatpants and that you're, you know, trying to, again, I'm super fortunate in my setting. I literally have support from the president down. So like, it's almost surreal sometimes that I'll walk around campus and the level of respect, not that we shouldn't, it's how it should be everywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think I've done a lot of things career wise to, I don't know, that look more professional, because I don't just look it, but like to be respected as that professional person and truly like professional strength coach position, you know, to have that level of credibility that you're not just the person in the weight room,
mm-hmm.
that is like the knuckle dragger meathead, right? So like, you know, how do you carry yourself? How do you interact? Do people even know you on the other side of campus, right? Like, I'm fortunate. I spend a lot of time out and about just on campus. I have a therapy dog who goes everywhere with me. So like, we're just kind of integrated into all aspects of it. But again, it's easy if you're the only person with all these teams and not a lot of help to just stay stuck in the weight room and keep your head down and not necessarily. So I think it's the organization, NSCA organization, has to continue to push this envelope that the strength and conditioning professionals are subject matter experts. And then the people that are in those positions can't just shoot themselves in the foot. They have to step up and raise the level as well. I remember back in the day, the Major League Baseball Professional Coaches Society, the PBSCCS, Professional Baseball Strength and Conditioning Coaches Society. It's a mouthful. Some of the guys, Fernando Montes, who's in the tactical space, right? Those guys were leading the PBS CCS, and they were like, hey, you guys need to stop dressing like slobs because nobody takes us seriously. And so they actually made their members, these coaches at their symposiums, they wear shirts and ties at the symposium now. And it's very dressed up because it's like, they're not going to take you serious if you're wearing the gray sweatpants. And so, you know, you have to kind of raise your level of professionalism as well.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, you know, we all just want to wear sweatpants. I tell people that's the best part of my job, regardless, anyway, when they ask. But
no, and I know it can be a sensitive subject for some. I guess this kind of leads me to a follow-on sort of curious question of my own, which is that a lot of the medical folks that we've had on here talk quite frequently about this evolution in medicine, where we're seeing a lot more quote unquote exercises medicine, and you're seeing a lot more physicians that are taking an interest in barbell training or resistance training. And even some, I mean, I was on a call today with a medical professional who's building out a primary care practice that has a gym in this space, which I think is awesome. But I'm curious, like when stuff like that arises, say in a medical space, a medical symposium, whatever, does the NSCA get consulted for that type of thing? Or are we just seeing like other organizations create their own brand of strength and conditioning that might be unrelated to what we're saying is best practice?
Yeah. I mean, I think for those situations, it's probably the latter you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they're just doing it. Yeah. I think from time to time that'll come across to the NSCA. But again, if it's not really something that's big enough to make a difference, or, you know, something where people can really sink their teeth into and say, this is going to be the best for the masses, it's hard to put a lot of emphasis on that because mm-hmm. there are so many, you know, I mean, one of the biggest knocks is just that the NSCA is trying to serve, you know, so many members in such a variety of aspects.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming up on the hour mark here, and I'm gonna take this opportunity to steal Drew's normal role. He usually asks the like fun closer question.
I'm the fun guy on the podcast.
I'm the nerd. That's what it is. So we've talked a lot about various stages of your career, and we've talked a lot about like how coaches are educated and trained, and we've spent a lot of time on like the NSCA specifically. So we'll do a keys to the kingdom kind of question here. Say you're like tomorrow, you're put in charge of the NSCA, you're running the show, you can make any changes you want. What would those changes be?
I want to see somehow a practical portion of the exam put in, right? I think that's key. Obviously the scalability of it with 8,000 to 9,000 people a year that take the CSCS, just it's right. That's why they can't. So if I was given the magic key to change it, that would be probably one thing that will happen with the accreditation piece that's coming by 2030 is that there is going to be a lot more mandatory hands-on in the way of like practicums and internships required for those degrees. And, you know, most schools do require them, but again, they're going to be hopefully more impactful because of the level of accreditation and the hoops that that's going to require people to jump through. Maybe it won't, right? But hopefully you'll have more opportunities to have had hands-on experience through that process, whether that happens or not. So I think those would be the biggest things. And I think, again, more of the smaller 2 and 3 day opportunity, like different events, almost like the way that the practitioner's course is set up. Like we don't really have that for any other demographic in the coaching world, whether it's person training, you know, athletic strength conditioning or any of those areas. So I think more practical and applied opportunities that would provide education and hands-on experience and those networking opportunities in those smaller kind of 2-3 day event type settings would be like kind of my big ones to integrate with.
So I know Alex just told you he's going to steal my job, and as you were talking, I've decided to steal my job back, because we would be remiss for not bringing this up. And caveat, this could become a podcast in and of itself, so I don't feel like you need to give me a monologue, so to speak. But given that we want to kind of raise the bar in terms of what's required with the certification process, what can the NSCA do to bump up your average pay for some of these coaches? Because that's a huge thing we hear all the time, is that coaches aren't being paid enough. And I know the industry can dictate a lot of that, but I'm just curious as to the NSCA's take on where coaches' salaries tend to sit, given that we're asking more of them when it comes to the education piece.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part. And because so many schools are different levels, right? That's what the NCAA will claim, right? The reason they don't really want to choose a side for a certification, all this, is this institutional autonomy stuff that they claim it's true, right? There's differences in the levels. So I think those are areas that you have to consider. But I mean, I was the fourth person in 4 years to have this job at Norwich. Now they changed it significantly to get me the salary and having a full-time assistant, which were two of the pieces that I asked for. And so schools just have to step up. And again, maybe I was at times at the NSCA headquarters. We were in meetings with Brian Hainlein at the NCAA. I think I don't know that even the NCAA is interested in getting involved in that aspect though either, because, you know, if you think about it, sport coaches across the board get paid shitty in a lot of aspects of collegiate coaching. So, you know, it's a coaching that we love to, you know, say that we're the poor me like stepchild, but you know, it's all of coaching. It's not just strength and conditioning. So again, there's an emphasis that we have to help. The NSCA has to help really promote those people as the experts and as the SMEs and as the go-to people to be able to have them respected on campus, and to be able to show them from the administration, yeah, look, these people have certifications, whether or not it's a board, you know, whether it's not this board level or whatever, but it's a requirement. And it probably will be eventually, right? It's going in that direction, whether it's this accreditation and stuff like that. Like licensure is inevitable. I don't know that we'll see it, right? But
yeah,
it's definitely going to be there at some point. So, I mean, that would be the biggest thing. I think you have to just keep on and getting these examples like Norwich now and like some other places that are making changes and making the investment in the people and then being able to show that it's actually paid off. So that's the toughest part.
Yeah. No. And like I said, it easily could become its own episode, and maybe it's a rabbit hole we dive down in the future, but I want to first off, thank you for coming on, and then also commend you for all the work you've done over the years. I know as a strength coach myself, just kind of reaping the downstream effects of the NSCA, you've played a huge role in that. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
No, I appreciate that a lot. No, thanks. It's been, like I said, I never thought that I was going to go, it wasn't on my radar to go try and work at the NSCA someday. It happened, and that's the way it did. And being from a small town in Vermont, I was waiting every day, like imposter syndrome, for someone to be like, wait, there he is. That's the guy, get him out of here.
Man.
But I had such a great experience, and I think it was important to give back to the organization. You know, I was a little frustrated as a member. I remember that being, I was going to let my membership lapse. I didn't feel like they did much for me. And then, you know, the opportunity presented itself, and I was like, well, I could complain more about it, or I could take this job and go work there and try and make a difference. And so I think it's great when people have the opportunity now to do that, or get on committees and get involved and try at least and make a difference in the organization. So I don't know that I'll make the episode, but I have to tell you this, it's just funny.
Oh, we're still going. We can.
Yeah, you mentioned CrossFit. When all that stuff went down, I actually worked at CrossFit SoCo. Kevin Montefiore.
Oh, small world. I know Kevin.
Kevin's great dude. So one of the first people I met when I moved to the Springs.
I'm going there Friday. I'm going there tomorrow.
Nice. Tell him and Garrison, I said, and so I taught a barbell strength class for him. And so like this whole time that this lawsuit was going on, and they were subpoenaing all our emails, like you couldn't delete anything. But like I had emails going back and forth with Kevin about like, hey, what time am I teaching tonight? All right. Yep. You got this. And I was like, I was one of only like two people that didn't get deposed for the CrossFit lawsuit. Oh, and
we need to do, we'll do a CrossFit lawsuit episode, I think, because it'd be a fun, if nothing else, it'd be a fun conversation and a cool history lesson maybe, or right. We'll piss people off. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh man. But no, we'll leave that in the episode as a teaser.
There you go.
Awesome. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.